This is Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
The MPO Policy Board held its monthly meeting on February 20th, 2008. Highlights include an update on the Charlottesville Transit Service, a discussion of changes to the Virginia Department of Transportation's State Transportation Improvement Program, and the presentation of the Travel Smart concept of individualized marketing of transportation choices. MPO meetings always begin with a public comment period, and Charlottesville Tomorrow's recording begins with the first and only speaker.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Kleeman. I live in Charlottesville, and I noticed on your agenda there's going to be a discussion about the STIP-TIP six-year program unifying and system investment process, and I read through the material that was provided, and I'm a little disconcerted at the direction of trying to take what is, as a result of the 1991 ICE-T Act, which was to try to bring the significant decision processes for local transportation or regional transportation into the region and let them be the driving force for meeting their long-term and short-term transportation needs. And it just seems that the proposal is to take this and refocus it from top-down, state doing most of the decision-making for the local region and then having the region sign off. And I agreed with Harrison Rue's comment that this really looks like it's taking the role of the citizen out of some of the decision processing more than seems to be justified based on federal requirements for regional planning. So I'm curious to hear the discussion that's going to be presented, but since I can't participate, I have to anticipate what it might be. And then I would also like to suggest that as this discussion moves forward about what's being proposed to combine the STIP and everything else, to identify where the actual participation opportunities for the public would be in that process. How much would be generated as far as starting input from the local transportation planner, bodies like this, city, county, and the public, and to ensure that there's a reasonable opportunity for the public to drive their transportation future. It just seems like it may be going in the wrong direction, and I hope you can address that as you go through the discussion. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Senator. Anyone else in the public have comments they'd like to share with the board? If not, would anyone? I mean, we could probably just move forward into the discussion.
I think that's one of the discussion.
When we do, we'll address Mr. Senator Clinton's comments. Probably ought to look at our minutes. Does anyone have any proposed changes to the minutes that were in the board packet? I told you haven't had a chance to look at them, but if you'd like, we could defer them until next meeting, or if you're comfortable with it, we could always make an adjustment next time if you saw something. No comments, and I'll suggest that
there was a kind of a substantive difference in a point that I made on the second page of the minutes toward the bottom. We're talking about the Eastern Connector, and the last sentence says Mr. Rooker feels the steering committee should consider making the Eastern Connector a primary road because there is more primary funding available. I think part of the point that I was trying to make there was that that in making a decision about the route, they need to make certain that they consider the potential funding sources that might be available for the different routes, and that really didn't get in here. So if we could add that to the minutes, because I think the committee needs to. One of the things that seems to be absent from the discussion in the presentations I've seen on the Eastern Connector is potential funding sources.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a decision on a route without considering how it might get funded and what pots of money it might qualify for is kind of somewhat making a decision in a financial vacuum.
Mm-hmm. And that is what you said. So, mm-hmm. Great. Any other tweaks to the minutes? Then all in favor of adopting these minutes with the adjustment that Dennis has offered, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And then object. These are the minutes.
First and second.
Okay, if you want to have the first and second, I'll be open here.
I'll move approval.
Second.
All right. I'll repeat the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All right. Next thing on the agenda is the transit updates. And Bill?
Good afternoon. If you could pass these down. CTS is having a very good year for ridership. We have already surpassed 1 million riders for the year. That's the earliest we've ever done that. We're up 11.5% over where we were last year, 7 months into the fiscal year, and that's more than 100,000 boardings over where we were last year. We have been doing our fare free with UVA photo ID program. I think that's a big cause for the ridership increase. We also work with the county to add another bus so that we're buses every 30 minutes on our Route 5 service between Barracks Road and Walmart. And the city added Sunday service. So I think all of those things are contributing to a strong ridership growth. We're ordering 10 buses as listed there. Those should be ready to introduce into service at least by our August service change at the end of the summer. We are proceeding with our replacement facility, which will be out on Avon Street. The County Architectural Review Board has provided approval, and county planning staff now has the site plan and is doing the final site plan review. So construction on that facility will begin this summer, and this will be another LEED facility, just like our downtown transit station. Looking to next year, we've been working with the county, and the county has agreed to partner on adding night service to Route 5. So the day service was improved this year, and it looks like we'll be improving the night service on Route 5 next year. The city is looking at adding service using the Preston Avenue corridor between downtown and Barracks Road Shopping Center, and then that service will continue up 29 to Seminole Square. The city's looking at service between downtown and the high school, looking at additional service on what we currently call Route 3A, the Belmont Loop, and additional service between downtown and the UVA hospital. We are in the process of updating our rider's guide because we will have some service adjustments on March 24th. Probably the most notable is night service between downtown and UVA hospital. We will be introducing our real-time passenger information service. We'll have 25 stops in the field where we have bus finders. You'll be seeing some advertisements in the near future if you haven't seen them already. We had something in the Seaville yesterday. We'll have something in the Hook tomorrow. We'll be in the Cab Daily. We'll be in the Daily Progress. We'll also have some view screens at the downtown station, and online access to real-time schedule information will be available.
Bill, excuse me, how many of those real-time spots are going to be in the county versus the city, you know?
Almost all of them will be in the city. There will be one at PVCC that's in the county. There will be one at Walmart that's in the county. There may be others, but none of them are coming to mind.
You know, it might be helpful at some point to get a table which shows the amount of the number of boardings that take place at different places. Do we have that information?
We do not have the information, although one of the things that Harris and I recently had a discussion about is that we're in the process of doing a comprehensive data collection that is federally required because we're a federal funds recipient, and we can extract from that data that kind of information, and we're talking about whether VDOT might help us with that kind of extraction. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we'll have a lot of raw data, but we don't have any resources right now to do the extraction.
And Bill, we should note that the reason for that is that the VDOT modeling crew are updating our regional transportation model have really requested as much transit data as they can so that our new model will be able to measure and predict transit mm-hmm. use, which is a good thing.
Yeah. In terms of the bus finders, I would add that this is the tip of the iceberg. This is an introduction. There are many significant locations that would be very good sites for bus finders that we're going to need to work with private property owners. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Fashion Square is a very logical place to put one. But it didn't seem like it was going to be in a very expedient site to install one, so we're going to have to save that for another day.
If there are any specific places in the county where you think it might be productive and it'd be helpful for Dennis or I to talk to private owners, we'd certainly be happy to weigh in anyway.
Okay. Well, the county office building, I don't think you mentioned that, did you?
Nope.
I think we could talk to those folks.
I'll send you the price list. We are going to be making a change for those of us that are regular riders. This will mean something for those that don't ride. It may not. We're going to have what we call a universal transfer ticket. The CTS has a somewhat antiquated transfer arrangement that is route specific. It's very cumbersome for us to administer, and so we're going to make it simpler. So basically, when someone gets a transfer, they've got an hour to use the transfer. It will be much simpler. It will be color-coded by day and all that, but otherwise it's universal in the system. We have submitted our request for capital grants. Certainly don't know yet whether we're going to get funding, but there's a whole array of amenities that we're looking to be able to get for bus stop improvements and some other things related to capital needs. New capital item that I think might be ready for service before I next report to you, so I put it on here separately, is that we will be getting a low floor style trolley style bus, so we'll have the cosmetic appearance that is very similar to the trolleys we currently run. Of course, they're actually buses. But this will be low floor, so there won't be stairwells like there are on the current bus. And again, one of the other factors that if you're not a rider, it may not mean much, but it will have a rear engine. The current models have a front engine, which has a lot of operational problems associated with it. So we hope the community will receive this new low floor style well, and it may become the trolley of the future. If it's not well received, then we'll probably experiment with something else when it comes time to buy another trolley. So that's it. CTS, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yes?
On your 8 35-foot buses, 130-foot bus, et cetera, are there any changes to the form of those buses? Or are they the same buses you're using now?
The 35-foot bus and the 30-foot bus are going to be Gillig's. So that's actually a bus that UTS is running. The current large bus we run is a New Flyer. But again, from a community perspective, unless they're sort of a bus nut, they're not going to notice much difference. It's going to be very similar.
Mm-hmm. On Route 5, do we have an indication of the ridership increase that has occurred?
Yes, we do, and I'd be happy to shoot you the detailed numbers. I've been shooting them to various people. We're getting a good ridership bounce on Route 5.
Good.
We're getting a very good ridership bounce on our Route 7. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I've been in the community now 3.5 years, and when I arrived here, the trolley ridership was substantially higher than any other route. And now, without really changing the volume of service, Route 7 carries more folks than the trolley does. And I attribute a lot of that to the fact that we've now basically opened the doors of that bus to the university community.
Mm-hmm. Bill, when you looked at these buses, did you, I know you looked into some kind of hybrid drive or something like that. Is it just too expensive or not proven enough yet?
These buses are actually spending funds that I think were in some instances awarded before I even arrived here.
Okay.
The future does hold contemplation of hybrids. These are going to be clean diesel buses. It's going to be a city decision, perhaps if we move rapidly toward a regional transit organization, a joint city-county decision on what we might do with FY 2010. We don't have any big buses in our capital program for FY09, but we do have some in FY2010. The premium for a hybrid is pretty steep. We talked about that a little while back. It's going to be about $200,000.
And Bill, I'd welcome the same data on the bus routes that you're going to show it to Ben.
Send them to your email.
Do you have anything from the 2B route?
Yes, I will send that simultaneously. It is doing quite fine. It does roughly what the other neighborhood routes that have a similar level of service do.
Okay, good. That's enough. Donna?
Hi, I don't have a written report today, but I do want to point out that we've ordered 7 new vehicles, which should be coming in later this fall, too.
Donna, can you mention your...
Jauncey with Jaunt. And one of the things we have grant applications out as well, a couple of which are probably interesting to this group.
Buses, what size buses do you use?
We're looking at mostly 16 to 18 passenger vehicles, but we for the first time have applied for one larger vehicle that will hold about 23 people for our Buckingham service that comes to Charlottesville, but it'll be available during the day for Charlottesville Albemarle area. Partly based on ridership, and also our buses often have to squeak into some fairly narrow places. So if we get anything any larger than that, we have some difficulty getting to the people that we need to get to, because our vehicles need to be able to be flexible between Charlottesville and every place out in the boonies and everybody's tiny driveways. And so we have some significant issues in terms of reaching people. One of the things we've applied for this year is a grant to hire a mobility manager. It's a one-year program. And for those of you who remember back, if you were around here in the 70s and 80s, Jaunt, and we still are, the Community Coordinated Human Service Agency transportation system. And over the years, we have seen lots of the agencies branching out into getting their own vehicles or not really understanding why it makes sense to use a coordinated system as opposed to getting their own vehicles and trying to provide some of the services themselves. So for this mobility manager, it would be a planner who would basically be a transportation consultant and go out and meet individually with each of the human service agencies and work with them in each of the localities that they serve. So Jabba, for instance, we'd be in Fluvanna and Louisa, as well as Charlottesville and Albemarle and Green, to say, here, you know, what transportation gaps do you have? What kinds of needs do you have? Do you have vehicles of your own? How could they be used most sensibly? Does this really make sense the way you're handling things? This rose out of a meeting I had with a new Region 10 director who said, I have 70 vehicles and I don't know why. And this seems to be happening kind of universally around the area. So this is our chance to sort of take a hard look at what's going on and hopefully provide some really good help to the agencies that we serve and the ones that we don't, about how they can best approach transportation so it's more efficient, better use of resources, and we can also find out where the gaps are really specifically so that we know where we need to go next in terms of providing transportation. So we have our fingers crossed that we get that grant. We have a couple other grants, but they're out in the rural areas and wouldn't touch on Charlottesville and Albemarle. But the one that would touch on Albemarle is we're also in the process of applying for a grant from the Department of Aging, which is a really quick turnaround, as in 2 weeks from today, to provide some service to fill in a gap that just developed in Albemarle County. Southern Albemarle Family Practice is a nonprofit healthcare facility that provides a lot of care to folks who don't have insurance, and they provide their care on a sliding scale basis. And they've recently lost a physician and are turning people away. So that was sort of the impetus for saying, hey, how can we help? There's a small grant we can apply for that would take people from the Esmont and Scottsville areas and take them to the Central Virginia Community Health Center in Buckingham. We'll also then travel through Fluvanna, so we'd be serving 3 counties, and this would just be 1 day a week, but it's a way to pioneer some service going in a whole different direction from what we've been doing and also fill a gap that we see. The other thing that Central Virginia Community Health Center has, dentistry, which is not available for low-income people elsewhere nearby, as well as mental health services. They will do patient education specifically for the folks we bring in so they can work on diabetes education, those kinds of issues. So we're hoping that if we get the grant, it would start April 1st, so it's a really fast turnaround. That's about it. We also are kicking off our brand new look, and many of you, I hope, will receive momentarily an invitation to an event on March 20th at 6 o'clock at the Jaunt Building, and we'll have our brand new vehicle design there, as well as we have all kinds of new features on our website, which They're not there yet, so don't go and look. New brochures and really a whole new approach to marketing ourselves, not only for what we already do well, which is human service agency work, but also trying to make more of an impact on reducing traffic and being more of a commuter connection. So we're pretty excited about that.
Great, thank you. And UTS?
I don't have any updates, but I do have a response to your update, which is that I ride the bus and it's crowded now. So you're obviously doing the right thing. Because I go between downtown and UVA.
Excellent. Dennis and I do have a tight schedule, so I'm going to go move right along. Mm-hmm. We're slightly ahead. And who would like to introduce the STIP tip process update?
I think I'll just say a couple things. I did put a caveat in our introductory memo, but which I think Mr. Kleeman and I are somewhat in agreement with concerns. But this is really starting as a good thing, and I think it's a great initiative on Commissioner Ephraim's part. I think the problem is we're only a third or half or two-thirds of the way there in executing it. The goal is to end up with, over the next couple, 3 years, one meeting that people can go to comment and have input on the regional plans and the state plans. And it's fair to say we're only partway there, which is my reservation. You guys want to take it from here?
Yeah, I think you're right, Harrison. I point out the memo from Commissioner Eklund in your package. I think it's a good memo that puts the STIP-TIP grouping process in context with his desire to have that one conversation where we talk about items that need to go into the TIP and STIP at the same time we talk about projects that need to go into our six-year plan. Right now, or in years past, we talk about the TIP a good 8 to 10 months after the six-year plan. Now the proposal is we have at the same time. One of the things in trying to work out the processes necessary to make that happen was the fact that we're spending more and more federal money in maintenance and operations areas where we've got a whole multitude of projects that historically haven't been part of the TIP. So they've developed a process that's used in other states across the country where the feds allow you to group the less significant projects, whether they be safety rail crossings, enhancements, maintenance, bridge repair. And what the grouping does, it allows the obligations to shift based on need without having to come to the MPO for a resolution every time. We do that already with our enhancements. But the major
when you say the shift within the same MBO area or the shift
within
the okay. So
right.
We're not talking about a regional situation
because
where
your funds are still allocated.
Could in effect be moved elsewhere?
No, because your funds are still allocated by the state formula. This doesn't change state law. But it does allow us the flexibility to move, if one project were to fall behind, to move the next one that's in the queue forward on the less significant projects. Now, the major projects would still be a full line item in your TIP.
John, as an example, I would say something like Hillsdale Drive or Meadow Creek Parkway be seen as a major project.
I would think so.
Yes, those would be considered major projects.
Be a standalone.
Your groupings would be when you look at this, the examples in the appendix in the back. You have we have a guardrail line item on there, and we have it for signs and other things. What it does is we just group it there, and then we don't have to come back and continuously ask for amendments on those items. So it's trying to take those. I almost said the same thing you said earlier today. Taking those ones that are not major projects and burdening the MPOs down with having to make these shifts. We do grade crossings for railroads and things of that nature. So if we find one where the railroad company's not able to do that one, we can move and put another one in place in the same region and move it forward without having to come back and do that. So, but as John said, if, you know, when we get to the bigger or larger projects that are significant, then those would be what, you know, singled out individually in the plan.
Well, with you in these groupings, you still are going to have the individual projects
right here.
But you're saying the obligation itself will be allocated to that whole grouping of projects.
Correct. And if I have what you're saying correctly, it would not need to come back to the MPO for a discussion. That's something that VDOT could just do on its own.
Yeah, it would be an administrative process.
They're not insignificant, but they're less substantial, is maybe the operative term.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the example you have in your packet is from the Tri-Cities MPO, which is the Richmond area.
I wondered why we have that.
And some of those, example. Well, if you look at just how many projects they have, and you all don't feel the pain, so to speak, as much as some of the larger MPOs, that if they had to act, which they have in the past, on amendments for each and every one of these, they have no time left over to do the rest of the business. Now, there's also the fallout at the state level, and trying to unify the process is, by grouping it, does, from a resource standpoint, significantly make it something that we can handle in terms of unifying the process. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, the STIP is a document, you know, this thick at the state level, and having to track and list obligations on every one of these small projects is a significant burden for staff to try to put in the same process as the six-year improvement program, which is where you're introducing your larger projects that will be continue to be their own line item in the process.
It's harder on us, it's harder on the public too. I mean, this is definitely an improvement you're seeking.
John, let's just play that out for one that I can think of would be to say if you grouped all bridge repair projects, for instance, which might be a logical grouping. That would mean that, say, for a repair to something like the Advanced Mills Bridge or Belmont Bridge, if you move from one to the other, it wouldn't come before this body for discussion. And, you know, based on stuff you've heard from the public recently, that's something where the community would like some input into, I think. You know, if you're unilaterally moving it
right,
from one bridge to another.
Yeah. And I understand what you just said there. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it from those particular bridges, we're on a secondary system. The checks and balances are that it's also part of the local governments. The discussion we have with them as far as where monies are moved on secondary programs, and so it's still part of that, and it is part of the overall appendix plan here. Mm-hmm.
What's the timing of when you're? Why don't you walk through the timing of that, because it might help a little bit to know. I'm kind of reserving judgment until I see the kind of projects that you're suggesting would be in the group projects versus the major ones.
Can you say timing as far as the schedule?
Yeah.
Let's see. All righty. This is going to be a transitional year, of course, because it's a new process. But it looks like in March of this year, we should be getting our information for the FY09 TIF. And the FY09 six-year plan will be approved in June by the Commonwealth Transportation Board. So it's going to be a short window this year in terms of being able to have that single discussion, but at least it's occurring at the same time, as opposed to, as I said in years past, we'd be having the FY09 discussion next February. So it is an improvement, and I think this first year we'll have some bumps and bruises and trying to get all the stars to align. But
And so we would be planning on doing our TIP process this spring, as well,
right,
in March, April, May. Unless the right word, doing the on-jam update, which would be fun, staff work.
Very fun.
I have a question. If you were to make those changes by veteran level, would localities be informed of those changes? Does it affect them?
Oh, certainly. If there's changes that are occurring in the secondary system, the Board of Supervisors is on top of their plan and what's happening.
No, I'm talking about the things that you're grouping now. Changes, if we sell as a bridge, for example, has been used. If you decide, so if there was a bridge in the county, is that moving forward, you want to do something in the city, would that be informed? How would that be communicated?
Right. There wouldn't be any change going from the secondary system in the county to the urban system in
the
city.
There's
two different.
So JPA bridge versus Belmont bridge.
Okay. Yeah, JPA Belmont might be a better example to discuss. If one was moving forward contrary or in a different path than what was contrary believed by everyone, you'd be in contact by our urban programs engineer or manager at the city level.
But it wouldn't get discussed at the MPO, is what you're saying. It would just be direct to the locality, which is sort of moving away from a regional conversation.
Yeah,
like.
And when you look at the city is administering their own construction program now. Mm-hmm. And so it would be something that would be discussed because, for instance, on the bridge, the city may come back and say that, you know, we're not going to be able to advance this project this year like we had anticipated. And therefore, we had federal obligated money on there that we need to reobligate. What that allows us to do is to take that federally obligated money, and you're moving your other bridge project faster than we can move the money from one to the other, working with you versus having to come back to the MPO to make that move.
But keep in mind, there's still projects that are already in the constrained long-range plan. So the regional discussion has taken place as far as setting up that group of projects that we're working.
Is there a way you'll be able to build into your process a notification of the MPO basically saying, hey, you know, within our purview now, granted, we're going to go ahead and make this switch because we're empowered to do so and it's a reasonable switch, but we're letting you know because, yes, the city's going to be told about it if it's a city switch, but to the extent we're also thinking about integrated transportation networks, mm-hmm. sometimes the county might be making decisions about something that relates to what was an assumed action in the city that now is going to be changed, and just not so much to have us validate the amendment, but if there's notice given and then we had a reason to be talking about it, it gives us a chance to raise our hands and say hello, maybe we should talk this through. Is there a way to build that into your process?
I think it's built in with the project matrix that we report on every month, which is more up to date than our 6-year plans or TIP, to be honest with you. It's a month to month where we are down to the milestone stage on projects, and I think it's going to be reflected in that.
So, John, you're essentially saying right now the way it is, those projects to switch dollars are required to get discussed by city and county together and VDOT at the MPO level.
Oh, yeah.
This would eliminate that requirement. VDOT can, again, just move it and assume to be a nice guy and inform people. To be fair, I don't think we're always seeing that kind of information, so that would be my one caveat. Institutionalizing the notice may be a way to sort of mitigate
sort of
that.
Like we did. I made my own to say, you know, to make sure I pass that comment along.
So it could get flagged and request to get this come discussed.
That even though we're making the moves around that, you know, there should be, you know, we'll put something together to notify the MPO.
Yeah, the goal being we don't want to be an impediment to you moving forward and getting things done. This is a more efficient system you're proposing, but if there's a reason why, when given this notice, that we might want to weigh in, you'd want to hear it. And it's just making sure that that doesn't inadvertently get lost.
And I think it makes sense to consider doing something of that nature initially as we start off, so that everybody feels comfortable with the process and can see how the process is working. So
I have a little, I sort of have to say this a little, you know, that the MPO would be giving up some of its federally, it's only federally legislated mandated power, which is to control, you know, whether a project moves forward or not based on its federal funding. So it's a significant thing for you guys to think about. We can assume that it's all about minor projects, but sometimes you know, there are projects that you guys really care about that you want to make sure you have something to say. On the positive side,
let me ask you a question. Is there a process here for the MPO to step in and preempt that? If they don't agree,
if you give us notice, can we stop you?
Exactly. I mean, if the MPO gets notice of a proposed change and we don't think it ought to be made, is there a mechanism here for us, line item, you know, taking one of these things out and actually creating a line item for it, and rather than leaving it within a group? I mean, I guess part of it depends upon how broad these groups end up being. We started out asking about the Meadow Creek Parkway and, you know, and Hillsdale, which mm-hmm. are $25 million projects or whatever, and you said you thought for sure those would be separate line item projects, but there's a lot of room between the $25 million project and a $500,000 project,
right.
or a guardrail, you know, which might be a $10,000 project. So I guess part would be helpful to understand the magnitude of the projects that we're talking about grouping.
Yeah, who decides whether they're grouped to be
right?
It's an objective benchmark that you compare to.
Is it a million? You know, right. Everything $1 million and less is going to get grouped.
If you can have
what's the cutoff?
Yeah, if you have a defined benchmark, it's like things below that value, you'd be given the prerogative, but you still have to give us notice, and there'd still be a process step where we could proactively intervene and say, wait a minute, excuse me. And, you know, you might be limiting us to a one-month window, but at our next MPO meeting, we'll have had a chance to look at it, and you've gone a little bit further down the path maybe than you would have ideally wanted to have gone if we were going to stop you. But the likelihood that you'd actually get stopped is small, but we might weigh in and inform your decision and make you rethink it sometimes.
Yeah.
It's just a safety net to protect us for what we might be giving up.
Mm-hmm. And more on the positive side, there's at least three or four examples recently where city and county have really worked together through the MPO to advance projects. Most recently, putting their own money into the Eastern mm-hmm. Connector project, switching the money from the city's, I think it was Fontaine, to start the prelim. You know, we would not have got that earmarked to build it if they had not advanced and moved city money to a mm-hmm. project. And that was done in conversation with the county. You know, there was a real agreement that priority was significant enough to move.
Well,
I don't want to lose that conversation.
Yeah, I think we've proven amongst ourselves that we've had good dialogue, and I don't see this process stopping the dialogue. I can't imagine there'd be anything that would happen that y'all wouldn't have some awareness of before.
John, if you and Quinn got bumped upstairs because you're good and we replacements weren't nearly so collaborative, we'd be giving something up we couldn't get back is the only point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I think to understand what the limits of these groupings are is mm-hmm. important, because it is giving up the only power we have.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen anything in writing about that other than commissioner's one-page letter, a PowerPoint that, you know, so as a written policy, I don't know if you guys have that yet or if we, you know. So I guess let's look at the details. The only other question that I have is really if there's any possibility of, I mean, I've made this comment, but I want the policymakers to understand it. Is any possibility of adjusting the timeline of your process? Because as proposed by the program office, you're going to go out and do the state and, you know, Culpeper District hearings first, and then get public input on that, and then give us a list and then of projects, and then have the regional meetings. And it seems exactly backwards in terms of it should be the regional meetings should come first and feed into. So the people can come here, and the 30 people that come and comment, we can incorporate their comments and feed into the state plan.
I think we do that now with the fall transportation meetings. You know, we have a process here at the MPO where we develop an MPO priority list that feeds mm-hmm. into that.
So would we still plan on doing that? In other words, would you be consolidated? Would you be having that meeting in March as opposed to the fall? Is it?
That's to be seen.
It used to be about 6 months apart, but what they're actually saying now is in March they'll have the Culpeper hearings.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need to develop a statement on that and then have our meetings with the public here about our regional TIP a month later after you've made your comments to the state, which is
a little bit backwards.
About 11 months backwards. Yeah. Anyway. You're not going to solve that today. I just think it's strong. Yeah, it doesn't meet our needs.
But you have public comment that's after the fact. It's not real valuable.
Yeah. I took those comments down, and we'll get them back to them.
What you're trying to achieve has some potential value, not just in terms of efficiency, but on many other levels.
We just got to bring a little bit of confidence.
Yeah. And we want to make certain that the comment that's received by the public. We have time before we get something sent down to us from above to send something from down here up above.
But keep in mind, I think the safety net that y'all have that isn't changing at all is your long range plan. If the project's not in your long range plan,
but John, that's a list.
It's not going to be. I realize
that's a big list,
but if you really aren't in support of a project that's in your long-range plan and you don't want to see it move forward, then
why might want it in the long-range plan, subject to certain conditions precedent in the system being built out, and if you guys were doing a shell game, mm-hmm. not for bad intentions, but for some unrelated purpose, we could have our vision of how things might progress. Disrupted, and we're doing local land use planning and making decisions that relate to our perception of how that will be playing, how that long range plan will be implemented. Not that we don't have the assumption it's going to all be implemented at the same time, rest assured.
So it's a question of setting the priorities to the projects within the long term plan.
Right. Yeah.
And we want to make certain that the input we have is not impaired to
understood.
Help set those priorities.
And you guys want that input. Not all of your counterparts, perhaps, in the future would. That's a concern.
And you'll still retain your input on the secondary system at the Board of Supervisors level and on the urban program at the City Council level. So that's unchanged as far as, you know, the Code of Virginia, you know, gives that priority setting to your bodies. So
just to summarize, it sounds like you can achieve your productive purpose with some revisions to the process that are deferential to the concerns that the MPO is raising, and that sounds like it would be the ideal outcome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what we'll do is I'll make sure we get those comments back to them.
Well, at the end of the day, I assume that however this process ends up, in order for a plan that includes transportation projects, federal dollars to be approved for our area, we have to approve it.
As the MPO.
Is that?
You would approve the grouping of it.
Well, no, I guess I'm taking it beyond. There are two things going on here, as I understand. You've got this grouping that you're doing to cut down the size of your document and make things administratively easier. And not have to have a hearing every time some minor priority change occurs within those groupings. Second thing you're doing is you're combining the STEP process and the six-year plan process, and that's changing the process by which the plans get adopted. And that's really what we're addressing right now. I think is that's the second thing. And the question there is I want to make certain that we are not. As a part of that, we talk about, you know, us getting something back from the state. as opposed to us being able to give our input to the state before we get something back. Mm-hmm. And I want to make certain that we're not, that at the end of the day, the plan that is adopted for this area, I think under federal law, we have to approve.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if we get something back from the state that we don't like, you know, we could, I mean, I could see this process actually becoming a longer process if we're not careful, because the state could be sending out what it thinks is the six-year mm-hmm. plan, the step, and find that the localities are saying, well, no, these aren't our priorities. Mm-hmm. And so,
that's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I think there was a greater risk in the old process.
It happened 2 years ago. Yeah. It happened 2 years ago, and VDOT was kind of involved. It made headlines.
But with the discussion occurring concurrently, I think mm-hmm. there's a greater chance we avoid that.
There's one last thing that Dennis mentioned that I do want to bring to attention of policymakers, and you guys are all aware of this. When we do the TIP, VDOT gives us a project list that's similar to this one. It was about this much info about each project. We spend a lot of time doing what we're actually federally required to do, which is put maps in there so people can find out where the project is, put in more descriptions so they can understand what the project is. We've done that for years, and it takes at least a month or two of staff work to add that info in. John, you've labored a lot with us to make that system work. So when we get public input, people actually know something about the project. When VDOT is getting the public input with the short version, you know, it's, I don't want to say quite useless, but people don't know what this little list means. So it would be more useful input for you if you actually got the input on the ones with the maps and the project descriptions.
Well, there's a thing in this write-up that says MPOs are required to follow a comprehensive public participation plan and use visualizations in parens, maps and images to describe projects. So, I mean, that's in your document, I believe.
I wrote that.
Or you wrote that. That's a summary. It's a summary of what I assume that's what you it's a summary of what they gave you. So the question is how is that going to happen?
Are we compliant with it with safety lives, really? We will be if we follow it the way that we normally will. The state doesn't apparently have to follow the same rules that the MPOs do in terms of letting people know where the project really is and putting a picture or a map of it up. I mean, that's just the reality. MPOs are held to a higher standard under safety law.
That's the nature of a mandate.
You understand? Any other comments on the...
So, just given that you heard quite a bit of concern and interest, is this dialogue going on at all MPOs now? What we are having today here?
Yes. The desire is for each MPO to pass a resolution of understanding in support of the STIP grouping. The grouping procedure is actually going to be adopted by memorandum of agreement between Federal Highways and VDOT. And Federal Highways would like to see the MPOs are in agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you would like that passed at the March meeting, we would need to see our... Mm-hmm. I would say it would be fair to say much of what we've asked for, we'd like to see some change or a doubt, not just that it was noted. Mm-hmm. I think if VDOT is not moving partway on what's here, I would recommend to the policy board that we withhold our understanding and also make communication to Federal Highways that it's, you know, it's not meeting our needs. So let's see if you can get some of that at least addressed.
I'll do that. And like I said, we're working with each individual MPO on this, mm-hmm. and so we're getting everybody's comments and feedback mm-hmm. there.
I was just going to say, our MPO may be more than others. It's focused on the public input component of the deliberative process, mm-hmm. and so we might be more sensitive than some of the others, but mm-hmm. our lack of collaboration in this process change, mm-hmm. Characterized that way,
could probably be problematic, and we don't want to put you in that spot because we have a very productive dialogue going forward. So as much as you can do to help us integrate into the process revisions that are deferential to that concern, it would be really helpful to all of us.
And I think our key would be notice like we have on the minor amendments.
Yeah, and like I said, some of the things, as far as, notification, when we do that, I think, it makes sense, and, we should be aware of that, and if we're aware of that, we would be communicating. But what you're saying is if we're not here, you want to make sure that right. There's some mm-hmm. process that says that that will continue.
And that if we had to weigh in and say, wait a minute, please don't, that there'd be a way for us to get a revision.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, in a way, I mean, what you're saying is you want the MPOs to approve this agreement that's going to exist between VDOT and FHWA, but we don't get to see the agreement.
Good one.
So I mean, it'd be helpful for us to understand what that agreement's going to say before we.
I think the agreement was, in the blind was shared at the December video conference. I'll have to dig that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you can't find that, let me know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The memorandum of we've
been video conferencing since last summer on this process developing with all the MPO staffs and not the policy board. So sorry to say you're the last to find out, but MPO staffs across the state have had input into these changes.
Mm-hmm. And we've been sort of saying the same stuff, and we've been hopeful to date that some changes would be made that have not yet been made. So it's coming to you without endorsement.
Well, we don't even know if they've been made since we don't have a summary of what it is we're supposed to approve.
I think we can move on and wait to hear from Quentin. Mm-hmm.
We want to understand and agree with conceptually what we're trying to do, but you want to make sure.
There's clear benefits.
We want to make sure that we address some concerns that you have.
Precisely.
Excuse me. Harrison, could the CHARP committee be briefed on this at our next meeting?
Yeah.
I really think we need to be informed of this in depth, in the same depth that the MPO was.
Or maybe even more.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Any further comment on the system process update? If not, then we will race along the RTA. We have we had a productive session, I would say. Harrison, do you want to?
I would say, yeah. If I could write the Daily Progress headline, it would have been something like Regional Transit Authority Study on Track.
They didn't get it right, did they?
Instead of $138 million about to be spent.
Yeah,
and without a consensus of support. Yeah, which way?
But anyway, yeah, I think I would just assume hear from any of you who were there about how it went.
Well, just to correct this for those who may not have been there, if I could.
Yeah.
I do want to say that on February 11th, we did have a joint work session with the county board members as well as the city council members. And we presented the work thus far on the RTA study and where we were, including the MPO's recommendation, MPO Policy Board's recommendation to the larger bodies that they wanted us to pursue or continue to investigate the development of a regional transit authority. So with that in mind, we brought the two bodies together to sort of have an across-the-table session to be able to ask each other questions and give further direction to the consultant. And to our delight, we had unanimous decision to move forward with continuing or finishing the study with the RTA as the direction of pursuit. So with that, I will open it up.
I would sort of add to Melissa's comments and tell me if anyone who sat in the room saw it differently, but I think we were really asked two fundamental questions by the consultants and the staff in that joint session. One was, in a hierarchy of governance options, with the RTA being the most robust, where did the joint group think we ought to be? And the consensus view, the unanimous response, I think, was to support what the MPO recommended, which is we go for the Regional Transit Authority, try to get the requisite enabling legislation next legislative session, and that we collaborate with other jurisdictions, namely Richmond and Fredericksburg, that might be seeking similar enabling authorities so that we can enrich the possibility of success. And the second question brought in front of the group was among, again, a hierarchy of different system implementation options, the most robust seemed to be embraced, with the caveat that to the extent that it included an upper end price tag of $138 million, there was a number of folks, including myself and Dennis, voiced concern that this shouldn't end up on the backs of real estate property taxpayers, number one. And then number two, to the extent, as Mayor Norris from Charlottesville pointed out, a good chunk of that significant price tag was associated with creating a dedicated lane, you know, new pavement, so to speak, along 29, that there may be other ways to implement a very significantly expanded and very effective system short of that capital element. But that didn't mean, as I took it away, that the group said we don't want to do that. The group said we do want to move forward comprehensively, but we want to be mindful of not doing it imprudently from a fiscal standpoint. Is that a reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. Mm-hmm. I think that what we the other thing is, I think what we basically came away with is that we want to do everything necessary to get this in a posture where we can ask for legislation in the next session.
Absolutely.
So whatever it is that we probably needed to meet with our legislative representatives sometime in the next few months so that we get a clear understanding from them exactly what the actions we need to take between now and the fall.
Yeah. And we're on track for that. I would add two more things. One, just to be clear, there was not a vote taken. Again, this was a work session. Right. Neither Board of Supervisors or City Council took a formal vote. We did poll each of the elected official president, and they all spoke individually, and there was a consensus, really, that was reached there. Only concerns are really, should we go with the lower end of the highest function of transit, or should we go with the high end in terms of the actual dollars? The other main message that the consultant presented, which is not in the report yet, is really the preliminary look at potential revenues. And seeing that if we were able to get permission to do what Northern Virginia or Hampton Roads were in packages that were approved by the legislature, either of them would more than cover the high end of the transit. So that was good news to get. Not that we're recommending that, because a simpler tax would be a lot better, but at least we know that package did get through the General Assembly. So we're not out of range to consider an investment. I think, and even the high end, which we're not ready to recommend yet, would be something that's bonded over time and paid for over 20
years. And the revenue streams could cover that debt service.
Yeah. So again, we're
I don't think anybody embraced the $138 million solution. I think what people said is they would like to try to have a much more robust transit system.
Yeah.
That certainly is one option. And the consultant pointed out that his estimates of the capital expenditures are very soft at this point.
So I think that was a quick version. We're again excited. Consultant is back at work. We're starting to get some of the next versions of the reports. We expect to be back to you within a couple of months with the remainder of the work products.
Beyond that body of work, when we probably ought to ask next steps, make sure we do have a session with our legislators, and clearly they're busy right now, but soon, and we should probably get a recommendation from staff to the MPO about what specific next steps should happen and what time frame, and those may include if there's some additional research or analysis that needs to occur that's outside of the scope of that study. We want to make sure that we provide for those jointly between the city and the county so that we can arrive at the General Assembly next year all equipped, all of our ducks in a row, all our T's crossed and our I's dotted, so that we can get the enabling legislation. It's going to be an uphill battle, and our best chance of succeeding that first time around is if we show them that we thought it through thoroughly, and it might mean some additional study. So I would suggest that staff come back to the MPO Policy Board with both a timeline and an action list and maybe even an estimate of whether or not some additional resources might be needed to provide for a higher likelihood of success next session so that we can have those considered quickly.
Okay. Well, listen, let's add that to our next transit technical meeting.
All right, so are others in agreement with that?
I agree. I think at some point, perhaps, a representative of the city and a representative of the county, and maybe the county attorney and the city attorney, could sit down with the legislators and talk about specifically what we're looking for by way of legislation. Yeah, it would be a give and take session, but so we can get a good understanding of what it is they think we might get approved, and also have the legal implications being assessed at the same time.
That'll be probably no sooner than about a month after close of session.
Yeah, like April.
Yeah. Also, were you going to consult with other MPOs which are trying to do the same thing?
Yes, yeah, we're in contact with Fredericksburg, and Fredericksburg and Richmond and Hampton Road as well.
It would also be useful to find out from people who have already gotten the legislation what to watch out for, what to avoid.
Mm-hmm. A good point. Yeah. Hampton Road has already taken a formal position that they won't change to be a simpler tax version. I mean, they're on record on that already. So we're looking at their recommendation.
Good. Well, I was personally really thrilled with the outcome of the meeting, the Daily Progress spin on it notwithstanding. I mean, I thought it was a very productive, clearly collaborative discussion, and I think we're going to move forward with this somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited. Should we maybe go on into our next item, which is we're privileged today to have a couple of guest dignitaries who are going to speak to us about a better mousetrap, and maybe Harrison, you want to introduce
the guest? Peter Newman is well known, and he's, this is his second extended visit to Charlottesville. I think he was here last year. He's well known in the field of sustainable transportation. I'll let his accent speak for itself. Randy Salzman is a local writer and activist, but I think, Randy, you've spent time studying these ideas in England or Oxford or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Oxford, and done quite a bit of research on it, as well as connected with Peter through Murdoch University before he went to Curtin.
Right.
He's just changed. They gave him more money and moved him across town.
And, you know, just as an intro to this, we do run the rideshare program and travel demand management, but we're, you know, eager to hear some great new ideas. I should also introduce Julie Monteith, who's at UVA, and they are going through a TDM plan as well right now. So we're all ears. Gentlemen?
Okay. I might just stand so I can see you. Thanks for allowing us the chance. I serve on a similar group to this in my hometown in Perth, and so I'm not just an academic. I know what has to be done through groups like this, and my research here has been on how regional planning is shifting and needing to accommodate these issues of climate change and peak oil, and what that will mean in terms of required reductions in VMT. That is now an international phenomenon. It's not really seeped through onto an American agenda yet, but it won't be far off, and that is difficult. That is very hard, and no one is saying that they can do that overnight. But this regional transit authority is clearly a very important step in that direction, and I would think that that will be historically very important in that regard. But any group like that needs to have both an infrastructure component and a softer, more cultural component to it, and both of those are part of my story. What I've done in Perth is deal with a quite a significant change that occurred in a very car-oriented city. I told this story last night in New York. I was up there for launching my book, and at the request of the DOT there, and they were really interested in it, and what we're ending up talking about, which is Travel Smart, they are very, very keen to see if they can adopt there now too. So let me tell you that story very quickly. About 30 years ago, they closed our railway down in Perth, and I was a local government councillor in Fremantle where they closed it down, and I started a group called Friends of the Railways to try and do something about this and get involved in the changing priorities of transport, and that we're going to put a freeway in instead. Now, we won that battle. The government was, in fact, deposed and over that issue, and they brought the railway back, but it was a very old, run-down, old diesel system, really dying, and the public had to then decide, what do we do with this? So over the next 20 years or so, we have made a series of decisions that have upgraded that system, electrified, extended it, and now it's gone, in the last few weeks, just before I came, an 80-kilometre section has been opened to the southern suburbs through very scattered urban development of a kind that is similar to any American city. Very low density, very car based, and an area that most planners would say doesn't deserve a railway. This railway has been opened with astonishing success. 60,000 people a day are using it, and the with 90% approval ratings, it was over budget, over time. We're in a boom time at the moment in our city, so every project is over budget and over time, but the project still had 90% approval rating. And along the way, each of the decisions were highly political and each one very, very positive in terms of rebuilding rail in our city. Now, this doesn't happen easily. We like our cars, like anywhere, and yet in a car-oriented city, it changed. We have gone from $1 on transit, $5 on roads, to $5 on transit and $1 on roads. That has been through the political process.
Amen.
And has happened. Now, this Randy's been there. He's ridden on the train system. It works, and it's highly popular. And we won 4 different elections on it. So it's politically very interesting as well. How did this happen? We certainly played all the political strategies and got politicians on side and so on. But you can't win things like that unless the culture of the people are also with you. Unless they've got some sense that this is really the long-term future and they want to move in this direction. And the other side of this story is Travel Smart. It's something that Randy has picked out as being a very significant thing that's been happening in Perth. I met him when I was here last because he'd studied this and he'd found this to be the best example of travel demand management in the world. And I came from Perth and I didn't know a lot about it. I knew it was happening, but I didn't realise its significance. And the more I've looked at it now, the more I can see. I couldn't have done what I've done with the trains if this hadn't been happening at the same time. What it is, there's a sociologist from Germany called Werner Brogue who introduced this idea of individualised marketing directly to households. Not a media campaign, direct one-to-one interactions with households to help them with their mobility management and how they could make different choices. Now, he planned this. He'd done a little bit of work in Europe. When he was discovered by some people in Perth, we trialled it. It was very successful, so we expanded it. Now, about 1 in 3 households in a city of 1.6 million have been through this process. We now have a Travel Smart profession with probably more than 100 professionals who call themselves Travel Smart officers. Every local government has a Travel Smart officer. Every agency, state government agency, has one. Every major company has one. Every university has a Travel Smart officer. Now, that's just in my city. It's spread across Australia. In Brisbane, they've just had a major trial which has had a very important success rate as well. And it has now gone to the UK. The UK have announced that they will provide a personalised mobility management service to every person in the country who wants it. And it is now coming to the US. 4 trial cities have begun to do that. Billingham, Durham, Portland,
Cleveland, and Durham, North Carolina, Sacramento, California.
Okay. Portland did their own kind of one. So Travel Smart is effective in this way, in that it has been providing people with options, and I'll get Randy to explain how it operates, because he's actually studied this and he's working on this and has become a genuine expert on it. But the results have been a permanent shift in about 15% of households giving up car use. Not total, but 15% of the of car use in a region, in a local government area.
Could you say that again, the statistic?
The 15%? Okay, yeah. the 15% less car use.
Car miles driven.
Car miles driven. So the 15% dropped.
Okay. Americans increased.
You trained 30% of the households and got a 15% reduction.
Reduction, directly. Yeah. With a 24% increase in muscle power transport. So biking and walking. 24% increase. And so the transit is going up, but there's a lot of non-work trips that are transferring. And that has been, it's like if you've got a real choice, then you can begin to take these other options. Now, the more we've provided the other options in terms of better transit, the more people will take them. So you've got to have both. You've got to have the infrastructure, you've got to have the soft part. But the interesting thing is that households love it. It's like, we're from the government and we're here to help you, and it happens to work. They write to their politicians and say, this is the best thing we have had happen to us. The evaluations have gone in time and again, and the benefit-cost ratios 67 to 1, because you can imagine if you can reduce, I mean, that is, I see your eyebrows raised, that's what our Treasury officials do too. Anything, the first time we did it, it was 40 to 1, and they didn't believe it. They said, it must be wrong. You cannot achieve that kind of benefit cost ratio. But we have been through those numbers with them. If you can transfer 15% people out of cars, the infrastructure and parking savings mount up enormously, and it really does begin to pay off. Now, I can well imagine a place like Charlottesville having very significant advantages because it is small enough to get this kind of program going. But let me hand over to Randy, and he can explain how it actually operates.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sure.
About the train system you talked about? You said you put in 80 kilometers. You have an 80 kilometer.
It's actually 88 miles round.
88. And you said a lot of it went through areas that were, I guess, more of a suburban type development.
It's all suburban
areas, centered. Yeah. How do people get from? I mean, what do you provide?
Good question.
How do you get people from their houses to the train?
Yeah, there are not many people can walk to the train.
Yeah,
some, but not many. Very close and totally rebuilt bus network that focuses in on the stations. So the train actually runs down the freeway for most of the way through the middle of something like Route 29, and where bridges go over the top, the buses stop at that point, they go down an elevator straight onto a platform, and there's, you know, a 30-second wait before you transfer. It's all an integrated ticket. We have an integrated system based on it.
We built the new stations at the highway bridges that crossed over.
Yeah. So there's that kind of...
You
also have park and ride.
System.
You have kiss and ride, as we call it, with drop-off facilities. And you have the beginnings of several TODs on areas where it really matters, where you can get proper centres where people can walk on. So it's a combination of all of those things. So the linkages are there. But very important to have that network to filter in.
Thank you.
In answer specifically to your question, the New Metro Rail, which is the organisation that actually runs this in Perth and Fremantle and the suburbs of Perth, they put on 250 new bus drivers. I don't know how many routes that is. When they put the rail in. But let me point out that only one place in the world and that's Portland, have they done a Travel Smart program in connection to an infrastructure change. Mm-hmm. Every place else that they've done it, there's no talking about the infrastructure at all. Mm-hmm. Okay, or there's no, excuse me, no changes in the infrastructure. It's just about, let's talk to people the way people need to be talked about. Mm-hmm. Okay, about how they change. Now, I'll go in a little bit to how it's done, but I passed around an article. This is coming out that, as you can tell, I wrote it, next month in Thinking Highways, which is an English publication, though they do have a North American edition. Okay, that's, you'll see some differences in the way that we use terms that'll show up there. There's also a similar piece coming out in Mass Transit, which is the trade magazine for Bill's industry, all right? And it lays out strictly in talking in terms of global warming, which is the only thing Americans seem to talk about. But there are so many other aspects to this. Now, the Australians are just, they've just exploded with ideas in the last year and a half, and they're now going into trying to figure out what the health effects are and how you show up at some place like UVA about people who are changing behavior towards transportation that's muscle powered. Right? And it changes around the world, every place is different. But on average, it's about 35% of the transportation change through Travel Smart programs goes towards bicycling and walking. Huge long-term health benefits. They're also, the OECD nations, which is basically the European Union, have decided that this is the way to go. And in 2004, they published a whole series of papers about soft TDM measures, transportation measures, and they figured out that the one thing they really wanted to know was, how much carryover is there, people outside of the marketing? Because you can't market everybody in the country, right? Right? And if you'll see on the back of that, this is the very newest data out of Brisbane. It's out this week, actually last week. And it shows a massive difference in the number of people who know about Travel Smart who are not marketed in 70,000 suburban households. We're talking about the North End. We're talking about Key West, where I used to live. We're not talking about downtown Charlottesville, where I now live. We're talking about those professionals who never show up in an American bus. Okay, so it's got huge, massive benefits. And the way primarily it works is not the way it would primarily work in America. Okay, got to keep this in mind. But what Werner Braun, He's a German and he's a cantankerous old man. You'll love him if you ever meet him, and you'll hate him too. Okay. What he does is they talk on the phone, and he hires people like Steve and Zach and Jerry over here, the people who are committed. And he says, you talk to these folks on the phone. I don't care what you talk about. Just talk. And eventually you ask them, have you ever thought about using alternative transportation? Talk as long as you want. No script, nothing like that. You talk, make a personal connection. Have you ever thought about using alternative transportation? And if they say no, would you? No, I don't think so. Thank you, hang up, forget about it. You're not going to change those people, okay? You work with the people who say, well, yeah, I've always wondered about it. And then they market them up to 12 individual meetings, some of them face-to-face, some of them on the phone, and some of them letters, handwritten letters sometimes. Werner Braun does not use the internet, period, end of story. He's very difficult to get a hold of because of that, because I'm writing him almost daily. He says that's not the way humans communicate. What happens with the internet is those people who are already committed, you go to it, but nobody else does. And that's certainly the way it's happened in my life, and I think it's probably the way it's happened to yours. So he does this individual marketing. And the first thing that happens is that he finds out where you live and where you typically go on an average day, you and your household. All right? And he takes that, okay, well, this is other ways that you can get there. Would you like to find a mountain? And then he has a list of things that people can ask for. It starts from bicycle maps, like Zach and Act has produced. It goes to the transit systems individual bus stop oriented schedule. So, okay, this is the schedule X number of yards away from my house for that bus stop right there. Okay? it goes to all corners of the state. They give away pedometers, they give away backpacks, they give away water bottles to people who have said, okay, I want to make a change. And then information is delivered by somebody who really cares, somebody like those of us, on a bicycle. I.e., they're modeling the behavior. And if you don't quite understand it, they call back the next night after you get it and basically say, huh, well, did you like the stuff? And then this is what happens, which is the entirely different will of what happens in all commuter connection programs. When you deliver it to the office, that HR person gets it, it's in a big envelope, and it sits there, and it sits there, and it sits there. It never goes anywhere. So Harrison knows what I'm talking about. They say, well, did you understand it? Everything clear? And basically, they force them to open it. Right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Oh, anything not understandable? Let's send out a bus driver to talk to you. And if they want it, the bus driver will then show up. And the bus driver will say, okay, this is what this means, the 6 different times, 7 different schedules from this bus stop. All right? And it goes on like that. In a year, in every single project around the world, over 250 projects, 3 million people, 4 of them specifically in the United States, they have never not decreased driving 8% over a year.
8% is the lowest.
Mm-hmm. 8% is the lowest. Now, that's what's really amazing to me, because that's the most car culture stuff in the world. Cleveland, Ohio, Durham, North Carolina, Sacramento, California. Now, there's a huge difference in some of the numbers. Bellingham saw a 22% increase in transit use. That sounds like a lot, obviously, to Bill Watterson right there.
I'm familiar with Bellingham.
But it's nothing compared to Sacramento, where they saw a 42% increase. And those numbers get to be real questionable. And those of us who are academics, I'm kind of a former academic, I taught journalism, broadcasting, and marketing for most of my life. And Peter's an academic, we say, well, some of those numbers just don't quite match up. And they get difficult. And it's very difficult to be able to understand how they develop this data. Right? But what is amazing about it is then Verner goes a step further. He gets unbelievable retention, respondents, I'm sorry, because he keeps calling back, in effect.
Can I ask you a question? Here, I mean, it sounds like this is incredibly people intensive.
It is unbelievable.
So how do you you're staffing to the point of you saying you're going to send a bus driver to somebody's house?
Basically they do it by neighborhoods, okay? Mm-hmm. And they start with a certain corridor or neighborhood, and they work that corridor or neighborhood until they work the entire project, and then they move to a new one. Mm-hmm.
You know this area. Let me just ask you, so I understand what we're talking about. You were bringing up Key West and areas like that. So you call somebody in Key West, and you ask them how they get where they're going. There's no bus going out to Key West. So what is it that you're telling them? You're saying you're going to send a bicycle guy out to Key West to deliver a package or something. Without an increase in the infrastructure to accompany it. I have difficulty understanding how in the outlying areas, I can understand how that would work in the areas where we've got bus routes, et cetera, but I'm trying to picture how...
You're right on the money.
You make this work.
Having lived in Key West and having tried to get the Ravanna Trail built along the river all the way out there and ran into Debbie Wyatt, okay, believe me, I understand. All right? It's a huge issue.
The case has been settled.
I know what you're talking about. But the thing is that if you have better infrastructure, the Sacramento situation, where they have a better transit system than they do in Bellingham, 42% of the change went to transit. There's definitely a correlation between the infrastructure and the change. But even in places that don't have a great infrastructure, they had an 8% change.
Randy, can be fair to say, wouldn't even in the places where you're not planning on significant improvements, you might choose neighborhoods that have higher transit potential but low ridership first.
That would be the smartest.
Okay. Right. Let's say Sacramento. How many people were hired to implement the program?
In Perth?
I don't know
because the Sacramento, it was a pilot project. It was done in 2004. The Federal Transit Authority was the funding agency. They paid $1 million for those 4 cities, which is a drop in the bucket, as you probably can figure that out instantly. I do not know how many they hired for any American city. Perth, which is still ongoing, or it's actually in Fremantle, which is where Peter lives. It's a suburb. They have about 20 employees.
That's not that many. I'm surprised. I mean, when you were describing how this was done, I mean, how did 20 people call 300,000 people?
The cost is kind of
where it deliver a package to them.
Some people say it's about an average of $50, but I think you better think about $60 or $70 per, because it's a translation between Australian dollars and U.S. dollars.
You said a max of 12, but some people are sold after one or two calls. Average is somewhere in the middle of six or so.
Right.
So
right.
It would seem to me too that you have to have an underlayment of existing infrastructure. Obviously, you could use this to support the arguments for expanding transit. But let's say we were supposed to start this next Thursday. Well, we can't even bike around here. In other words, there's fundamental infrastructure gaps for all forms of modality short of the car. How do you transcend those, or do you wait till we have enough foundational?
Well, David, I mean, that's exactly what I'd love to talk to you all about individually or as a group to do a full presentation, because I have a project that does everything right together. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it doesn't require, but it would certainly be helped by one small infrastructure change. And it has to do with Martha Jefferson moving. Martha Jefferson is moving from the city to the county. According to Juan Wade, the increase in numbers of cars going across the Free Bridge will double, 27,000 a day from 55,000. There's 28,000 today, he told us, and it's going to be 55,000 when Martha Jefferson makes that move.
It's 52,000 now.
Anyway, it's going to be a lot more good.
It's a huge increase, and you know, he just told us that off the top of his head.
It's going to be a big impact.
It's going to be a big impact. Well, so my thought, and this is the project that I've talked to Mr. Rue about and tried to talk to some other folks about, is about how you mitigate that problem and you solve the political issue. Remember, I spent most of my life as a reporter, a journalism professor, understanding completely the political issues. Or at least I think that I understand them completely. I probably don't understand them as well as you all do. But you know, you wouldn't be sitting here, you wouldn't be talking about Meadow Creek Parkway if you didn't know that when that hospital makes that move, there is going to be political pressure to build a new highway bridge. You have to know that. And let's say, and I'm saying, basically, look, we can think of a way that we do it now so that we don't have to build a highway bridge by doing, in effect, a Travel Smart style program, but only aimed at a small number of people, which kind of fits it all together. And I'd love to talk to you all about that, but we've already been here more than 15 minutes.
I'm going to suggest, Randy, that we do have you meet with our Community Mobility Committee, which is a subcommittee staff and local transit folks that focuses on these issues. And
well, my contact information is there. Yeah. Peter's only going to be here another week and a half, and most of that time is already full. But I will talk to anybody about this any time, because it's so important for our country.
Fascinating.
Very exciting.
Yes.
I'm going to make a suggestion. It's now 4:30, and we have a public hearing scheduled at 5. And I actually had hoped to spend just a minute offline talking to Peter Randy, and I know that Quinn wanted. Could we maybe take a break for half an hour, unless anybody objects, and then reconvene in time to have our public hearing at 5, which shouldn't last terribly long, and then we can take public comment after that, and Dennis and I can get to our next public hearing at 6 at the county building, and maybe somewhere in there get a bite of food. Would that suit everyone?
But you really might take Q&A. I mean, people might have Q&A now.
That's fine.
So
that's a good point.
We kind of cut them off.
That's
so.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Well, but have at it. So, yeah, you
okay. So I'm just trying to understand, as an example, you're seeing an opportunity with Martha Jefferson Hospital, and what you're thinking is that there would be some specific program around supporting people. Use this as an opportunity to start a program to transport people back and forth, or at least aid them in getting to the new hospital facility?
Not an infrastructure change, unless Martha Jefferson wants to do that, which of course it probably will when it makes the move. It's probably going to have to put on some buses. Maybe they'll hire some of Donna's buses down here to make that transportation issue.
Well, Martha made a proffer on that rezoning to contribute some money to our transit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a soft measure, which means that it's, in this particular case, it's an educational measure that's individualized marketing. The English plan right now, and they have not yet started it, they've trialed it heavily as well, and it's been such a success to them that they're doing it nationwide. It's slightly different. It'd be different than it would be in America. It changes every single project nationwide, and the equivalent cost is building 17 miles of interstate highway.
Randy, it seems like for an outfit like Martha Jefferson, one of the real benefits would be encouraging more employees to carpool. That would be one of the one of the options as well.
Yeah, and how you do that, the rideshare folks, Will back there. I mean, that's what you do. You match people, right? I'm on the list. I'm sure everybody else is. I did a piece locally for the little weekly newspaper where I talked about bicycle commuting, and not a single person, and I talked to basically 20 different bicyclists, including myself, I was the only one that was signed up for the guaranteed ride home. That's pretty much the problem.
This is a very good place to ride a bike around. It's a very nice town for cycling. I don't know why you say that about it. You know, you need a lot more infrastructure.
Peter says that because he's been riding my wife's electric bike.
It's great. And I honestly, no reason why a campus town shouldn't be deluged with bikes. And instead of SUVs, I mean, this is, you know, it's a heritage town, and it's being ruined by the traffic in ways that can be quite easily fixed if people change their approach and find that, in fact, it's a lot easier. I mean, I see students travelling 100 yards from, you know, a dormitory down to a shop or something in an SUV. And there are simple ways of getting people to change behaviour and to see that this is part of their responsibility of living in Charlottesville. So it's not, I mean, I would like to see something that was broad as well as the Martha Jefferson thing, that was more focused on the students as well, that the opportunities for just simply switching to bikes would be massive. And that doesn't require anything. It might be a bit more paint on the road here and there. That's all.
Randy, let me just get to this specific question because it's a little hot. You introed this at the beginning with one of the reasons why this is of greater urgency, the whole climate change, reduction of greenhouse gases, and transportation and land uses participation in that. You're aware, as I am, you know, that the land use transportation linkage is one of the toughest ones to solve, but it also is going to have the most significant sustained reductions. You know, we can talk about them. What I'm hearing on the Hill, I just came back from a conference, and I'm on the Governor's Commission for Climate Change, so I'm starting to really do a lot of homework on this, that these kind of reductions are probably going to be mandated by Congress at some point, that we're actually going to have to not only limit the increase in car use, but actually yield reductions over what it is right now.
And that's likely to happen within that 6 years that you are now planning that plan on.
Yeah, well, I'm reviewing drafts of legislation from Congress. I mean, I have no idea whether they'll pass, but they're starting to introduce them. Could you give us from Australia's perspective, when we talk with the MPOs here, most of my colleagues say the best we're going to be able to do is limit the increase in vehicle trips, and you guys have shown that
They're decreasing.
8% decrease is the lowest decrease.
Perth is 14%.
I collect stories other than my own city, and the book I'm writing with Tim Beagley is for responding to peak oil and climate change, and resilient cities, and there are cities that are now demonstrating it, and they're a little rarer in the US, but you haven't had the same pressure to do it politically. That will change. As you see, it's coming from mayors to state governors, and will change the upper politics. That's what's happened in Australia. We got rid of John Howard because he didn't support climate change. Mm-hmm. That was the number one issue in our federal election, and he lost it. And we signed Kyoto as the first thing that our new government did, with enormous political support for that. Now, they know that it'll mean changes. And we are having to introduce quite a bit of mandatory regulatory approaches. None of our cities have yet got that into a format which says you will reduce VKT in our case, or VMT here, by X amount. They are all committing to CO2 reductions of 40-50% by 2050, but they haven't quite worked out the detail of that. The cities that have developed their own strategies, and there are certain regions that have done that, have realised that that's what it means. Mm-hmm. It does mean reductions in VMT. You cannot achieve it by biofuels or any other simple means. And those have to be translated into the structure of the city. Now, we've had all our cities do regional plans in the last 5 years. They have all concluded the need for a more sustainable future based on less car dependence, transit prioritised with corridors and centres to make sure that the structuring of the city changes that. And what we find is that the developers very easily change to that perspective. It's very easy for developers to make money out of that. Some will lose because they've expected some vast areas to be opened up and scattered. Mm-hmm. But the same thing is happening in Australia, is happening here. The subprime mortgage meltdown areas are all on the outer fringe areas where those rezonings were designed to scatter housing. They are dying, and the developer loses as well. So they are coming back in and developing incentives.
You mentioned one more thing that for those of us thinking of regional transit already think about. By introducing a expedited marketing program like this, you're getting reductions in driving right away. You're saving families money right away. It's pretty instant.
And you're building the political
world. Well, that was my question. You mentioned 90% support for major infrastructure projects after people became aware of them. And were only a third of them were actually going to be using
it. Okay, that's what it opened with at 90%. It never dropped below 80 during 5 years of construction. Can I come back and answer your question, Harrison, to be specific? Everybody knows, I'm sure, about the London congestion charge. It costs you about $17 American to drive into the inner city on any of those 16 roads that go in. And you hit the ring and you got to pay. Well, one of the things it has done, okay, is it's decreased congestion dramatically, about 32%, and the pollution is about 14%, if I remember that number correctly. That's not on top of my head. But another thing it has done is it started a wonderful, terrible black market in fake license plates. Magnetic license plates, because that's how they do it. They take a photograph of every single camera that goes, every single car that goes through those 16 parallel roads, or whatever people would call them. Radio roads, thank you. They take a shot of each one of them. Mm-hmm. Well, you can go online and you can buy your own series of license plates and then you can sell it because they can't stop that. Right? That's the problem with not having a good marketing program that goes along with infrastructure changes. And the data that we would come up with a really good project isn't just simple data. It's actually how people change and why they change. Now, some of y'all know Gus Roby at DRPT. When I first pitched this idea, this project, before I'd even heard of Travel Smart, I'm a journalism communications marketing professor by trade and practitioner of those things. This was almost 4 years ago. Gus wanted to fund it. I had to find a place to do it at. I tried, first of all, I started at VCU, but VCU wouldn't listen to me. Okay, then I went to UVA. UVA really wouldn't listen to me. But the transportation research people out here often said, that sounds interesting. How can we fund this? We want to find out this data, the data that you could develop out of it. And then when I finally get down to Martha Jefferson, and Martha Jefferson, Ron Cottrell, some of y'all I'm sure know him, says, yeah, this sounds like something we could do right here. Mm-hmm. I went to Blue Moon Fund right over here, and the folks at Blue Moon say, yeah, this is something we'd like to find out about. We will fund it. But exactly how much and how big and how, you know, all that has got to be nailed down by having everything together in a package, right?
You can't do it without government.
You can't do it without government. You can't do it without.
Peter, could I ask you what was the infrastructure cost in Perth for the rail, and was the bus system in place that or did you have to dramatically expand the bus service to be able to tie in with the train system you have?
The bus system was in place and was not very successful. Mm-hmm. In each of the areas where we have put the rail in, the rail is significantly faster than the traffic. The buses are slower than the traffic. And that's the same in every city we study, even in those that have got BRT systems. The rail to the south, maximum speed is 130, the average speed is 90.
Kilometres.
Kilometres an hour, sorry. And it's, that's pretty... Sorry, got a transfer.
Still fast.
From Mandurah to Perth, which is the distance, it's 48 minutes in the train and it's about an hour 10 by car. Mm. So you get people out of cars and the bus could never do that. But we didn't put a single bus driver out of business because, in fact, they had to buy more in order to get the feed into it.
Right.
So we've had a significant increase in transit. We went from 5% 10 years ago to 10% before this train is open, and we believe this will take it probably to the 15%. Now, that's, you say these numbers are small, but there aren't many cities that have done that, who have actually got that kind of change happening.
Oh, there's a geometric thing.
What I was trying to understand, the investment that was made. You got the public will behind this, and then and there was a large project designed.
Fully state funded. No, there's no federal money in public transport in our country. You're a far more socialist system than we have, and we have no local government money in it either. So the state government funded it. At each stage, the first stages were less expensive to do. The total in the last 20 years has been $2 billion, which is still not a lot, to make a modern city's electric rail system. The last phase, the 80-kilometre phase, was $1.6 billion, so that was the expensive part. There were real big bridges to build and so on. But the interesting thing is it was paid off before it even opened. The Treasury...
No debt service.
There is no debt servicing at all. We have got a mining boom on. There is enormous wealth around, but the politics was such that people felt that was the right thing to do with their money. Mm. And that's why it's so important to have that kind of support. It makes the politics of things work so much better. The Premier of our state saying, we're going to build another railway. It was so exciting, this opening, and it was so great. That is such a change. From 20 years ago, where I ran this campaign, where everybody said it's futile. Perth will never have a railway system. And the reality is the politics has worked.
And there were a few years where they didn't have any commuter rail whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then it changed. I know the number is in a piece that I wrote for planning. I'm sure somebody here has it. It was in the January issue
this
where it
year?
Talks about Perth.
January of this year?
January 2008. If you'll email me, I can get you the number and email it back to you. The costs for the southern suburb rail.
I'm going to make a suggestion. Unless anybody else has a critical question right now, that we could and probably should talk about this for 2 hours. Maybe your next visit to the States, we can extend the conversation a little bit further. Does anybody have a critical question, or should we maybe take about a 15-minute break before our public hearing? That's all right. No. Then let's do that.
Thank you all for listening so long. Yep. We appreciate it.
Guys, I'll join you too.
Thank you very much.